I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on Smart City, we're going in-depth with one community's attempts to reinvent itself. With the economy in crisis, many cities are scrambling for solutions to their financial woes. Stamford, Connecticut has weathered many economic ups and downs by reinventing itself and is about to do it again with a series of civic conversations called Reinventing Stamford, Redefining the Recession. We'll speak with the mayor of Stamford, Dan Malloy, and Kip Bergstrom, the executive director of the city's Urban Redevelopment Commission, about bringing together civic, business, and governmental leaders to make a city stronger, greener, and more resilient. And we'll get some perspective from Robert Yarrow from the Regional Plan Association. He joins us to tell us how Stamford fits into the regional picture. Stick around for Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Stamford, Connecticut has been a manufacturing hub, a research center, and a seat for the financial industry. It's a city of 122,000 people, about an hour outside of New York, that has been home for many Fortune 500 companies, from Time Warner Cable to World Wrestling Entertainment. Now the city is about to envision its next evolution with a series of conversations called Reinventing Stamford. Kip Bergstrom is the man behind the series. He's the director of the Stamford Urban Redevelopment Commission, the development agency for the city of Stamford, and he joined us from his office to tell us how the series will progress. Kip, people must be asking, why do we need to reinvent Stamford? It's a pretty nice place. How do you answer?
Well, it's not so much Stamford as that has changed as the world around it. The Stamford story actually is one of continuous reinvention. It's reinvented itself probably five times in the last 60 years. And that ability to adapt to and evolve with changes is really the core strength of the city. And of course, these times are more dynamic than ever, so it's going to really need to call on its ability to evolve with the times.
What gives it that core ability to change, to be resilient?
Well, that's a good question. It's probably an openness to that possibility. You know, it went from a manufacturing center where it actually called itself the Lock City to a research center, and it changed its name to the Research City. Then it went to a Fortune 500 headquarters location, never changed its name that time. And then more recently, a center of hedge funds and investment banks, so you could call it today the Financial Services City. Again, it never chose to change that name, but why did those changes happen? Why was it able to do that? I think it was an openness to the possibility. It wasn't as if some folks got together and said, let's be a research city. It caught a wave. Its sense of itself is to do that, is to ride the wave, not simply stand there and let the wave crash over it. So it's a propensity to exploit opportunity. That's the fundamental core narrative of Stamford and its core strength.
How do you balance the promise of reinventing Stamford, the initiative that you've started, the dialogue you've started in your city, that really looks forward with what must be extreme pressure right now to produce jobs today?
You know, we are a financial services center, and the pattern of the last two decades has been that financial services was able to outbid everyone else for talent because they were so leveraged. Whatever else happens, I think everyone assumes that in the next evolution of financial services, there's going to be much higher capital requirements, much less leverage, lower profits, lower bonuses. They're not going to be out competing everybody else for talent. And, you know, in some ways, that's the silver lining in this whole crisis that we're in, that there's going to be talent available, both existing and newly minted, for sectors that have been rather talent-starved for the last decade or so. So I think firms more and more go to where the talent is. Of course, talent goes to where the jobs are, and it's a chicken and egg thing. But I think the fact that we have a large amount of very sophisticated talent makes us a a place where job creation is going to occur.
Stamford seems like the rare city that truly views itself in a regional context. To what extent does your city's success depend on the success of New York City?
Well, for the last 60 years, we've traded off that relationship. There isn't really a Stamford economy. There has been a New York metro economy of which Stamford is a part. And the evolutions in the development of Stamford reflect, to a large extent, the evolution of the New York economy. What's happening now is very interesting, is the economic geography is expanding. There's a mega region evolving, an integrated mega region that will run from Portland, Maine to Richmond, Virginia. And the interesting thing about that economic geography is it puts Stamford at the center of it. We go from being at the edge of the New York metro to being at the center of the Northeast mega region. And one of the things we need to do in reinventing ourselves is really exploit that possibility. How do we increase our direct rail connections to everywhere we can in the corridor, leveraging off of investments that are being made at the federal and state level?
And in that case, when you say rail, well, what do you mean? I know you mean passenger.
Well, 90% of the heavy rail ridership is on the Northeast Corridor now, and that will probably continue to be the case because there's major investments being made in both inner city and commuter rail. I actually think integrating the commuter rail systems is the big opportunity. More frequent, faster, more integrated commuter rail service. Our labor shed right now extends down into Manhattan and east all the way to the shoreline towns east of New Haven and up various branch lines to Danbury and Waterbury in Connecticut. And soon, we hope, to Hartford in Connecticut. And we're looking forward to the day that the Connecticut commuter rail system links up with the Boston and Rhode Island commuter rail systems. What the real potential is with rail is to expand labor markets. So you could imagine over time, when you have frequent and faster rail, that the labor markets that are now contained in the Boston Metro and the New York Metro get integrated, and that's extraordinarily to Stamford's advantage, to be part of the networks that would get created by the integration of those two now separate labor markets.
Well, clearly it is. And Kip, what does the world look like if we get there? If these initial federal investments in intercity rail continue to be followed by additional funding and we get serious in this country about rail, then what happens? How do cities compete? You say it extends the labor shed, and certainly it does, but it begins to change the way cities have to behave to attract talent. Are you wanting workers? Are you wanting residents? Are you wanting a mix of both? Can you not predict? What does it look like?
Well, you want all of that. You want the biggest labor shed that you can, because the bigger the labor shed, the more specialized and highly paid jobs you can attract in a location that can access that labor shed. That's why New York, which has the biggest labor shed in the country, has the highest paid and most specialized jobs. And it's also why Stamford does as well as it does. So you access to a broad, deep labor pool of talent is the number one criteria for success. You know, people have talked about transit-oriented development. I think that's going to be put on steroids. So how do you take advantage of this big federal and state infrastructure investment and connect to it on the ground in your local level? You know, everything from parking lots to sidewalks to shuttle services to light rail, streetcar extensions out from your train stations. You really have to exploit that network and really make the experience of using it for both the resident and the commuter a seamless one and a pleasant one from the time they leave their door to the time they walk into their office. That every single step of that connection has to be thought through and pleasant and seamless. And it's far from that today, whether in Stamford or someplace else. And the places that really work to make it seamless are going to have tremendous advantage.
What has to be different, Kip, when we come out of this recession in order to secure a better future.
The Madoff Ponzi scheme was in some ways a metaphor for the whole economy. The whole economy, to some extent, was an imaginary economy, a Ponzi scheme, both in terms of how we used credit, but also in terms of how we used resources. I think we all know that we were living beyond our means financially, but we were living beyond our means ecologically. And we've come to the end of that rope. So the next world, the next economy that we're moving into is going to be based on financial reality, but it's also going to be based on environmental reality. Stanford's a coastal city, so freak weather and rising sea levels aren't an abstraction. It's something that we have to think about and prepare us for so that when these inevitable, what used to be 100-year storms and are probably now 10-year storms, hit us, it doesn't destroy us, that we've anticipated them and we've planned around them. You know, this isn't some fantasy. This is a reality that's staring us in the face that we have to meet.
I've been thinking, Kip, about what it will take to be a next-generation great American city. What do you think it will take?
Well, I think it's a symphony of many parts with many sections. It's not one thing. I think each place has to find its distinctiveness and accentuate that. It's not a copycat. There isn't a cookie-cutter formula for success. There are things that are distinctive about Stanford that we need to strengthen. So distinctiveness is a piece of it. I think being a green city, and not just as a slogan, but really in a consistent set of behaviors and investments and infrastructures and ways of being both by the government and by the firms and residents so that you really do, in effect, have a low carbon footprint. People, particularly the most talented people, want to live their values. And so you need to be a place where they can do that. That is, in fact, a green city. But it can't be spin. It has to be real. And I think it has to be a place that is interactive, that's open to new ideas and new people, and that young people can get into the decision-making circles fairly easily. It's accessible in that sense. It's diverse, so a whole range of people of different backgrounds, of different incomes, of different values, of different lifestyles, because we know that innovation comes of diversity. So those cities that are diverse, that are kind of resisting this notion of everyone sorting themselves into like type places and really run counter to that, I think those are the places that are going to be most successful.
If you perceive a place not to be open, do you think you can be intentional about changing that, which really is a culture change that we're calling for?
Yeah, I think you have to be. And it's not like you're open or you're closed. There's a whole spectrum, and you're never open enough. So one of the things I've noticed in Stanford is that there are very discrete networks that people are part of and very little overlap between those networks. And that's not going to work. We need to connect the networks. One of the things I think folks are going to find, whether it's a person or a firm or a government, is that they don't have the capabilities to succeed within themselves as a person or an organization or a government. And they're not going to be able to build all the capabilities they need. The only way they can succeed is by networking with other folks who have complementary capabilities. That's going to become more and more true over time. So there is no place that is sufficiently networked and open, including Stanford. It needs to always be working quite intentionally to make itself more open.
And that's part of the reason you have developed this series of conversations.
Exactly. I mean, the whole point is to get people talking about ideas, and in that process, it really changes their thinking. I mean, you know, people really don't change by listening to other people. They change by talking, and that's how they grab onto new ideas and make them their own and act on them. So, you know, people ask me, what is the point of this conversation? And I said, well, that's the point, is to get people talking.
The point is the conversation.
Exactly.
But I think you're right. So many people dismiss the importance of conversation. I mean, it's like, why aren't you just getting people together to talk?
Yeah, that's how we let go of the dead ideas that are holding us back, and we have many of them. If we can't dance with ideas, if you will, or play with ideas and try them on and get used to them and make them our own, then we don't embrace the new ideas. And this is a time where we have to do that. We have to release old ways and find new ways, new paths to success. And that requires a lot of talking by a lot of people.
What are the dead ideas holding us back?
One of them is just hoping that we can just get back to the way things were, a simpler time or a time when, you know, we were really, in effect, living beyond our means. You know, there's an understandable desire for this crisis just to pass and for things to go back to the way they were. And that's not going to happen. There's a major state change that's happened or is happening, and we need to realize that and look at that. Those places that have a high standard of living are just going to inevitably keep that high standard of living, that like somehow the world owes it to us. That's an idea that's dead. It may be walking around still, but it's dead. No one owes anyone anything. You have to earn it every day. So those places that have been prosperous cannot count on being prosperous tomorrow.
Is there the moment beyond conversation, beyond dialogue, beyond the dance with ideas, when you know it is now time to move from talking to working? Or do you consider those things so integrated that there's no launch point, that when you begin to talk and dance with ideas that you are launching change?
Our hope, and I've seen it happen before, is that by bringing a very diverse group of people together to talk about the conditions that are facing us and to really honestly look at those and see in them both the threats and the opportunities, that folks will naturally start to self-organize to exploit those opportunities. You know, we're going to be intentional about making some of that happen, but we're also going to be open to a lot of it happening on its own without me or somebody else directing it. And I've seen that happen before. I think you need to create an environment where there can be a lot of grassroots self-organization of initiative. Part of what we're doing in saying it's really not a speaker with magic words imparting wisdom to an audience, but rather people talking, is right from the beginning, you're focusing on individual agency. And so it tends to foster people self-organizing, doing things, not trying to get somebody else to do something, but actually just doing something themselves. And of course, you know, people are doing things every day. And a lot of what we need to do is just do things differently. And you generally don't change your action until you change your thinking. And what this initiative is about is changing the thinking.
Well, to that point, when you're introducing new ideas and you're trying to get people to let go of dead ideas, our colleague Joe Courtwright has talked about a project in his hometown of Portland, Oregon, where there is a major bridge going in that he has very much opposed, and yet it continues to be justified on the basis of it's a green project. And people are not trying to hoodwink anyone. They really, I mean, the people pushing the project actually think it's a green project because it has bike lanes on either side. So I'm simply saying that even though people may be saying the same words, they may have very different understandings of what those words really mean. How do you overcome that problem? Because as you say, if people are working, but they're working on dead ideas, if they're self-organizing, but they're self-organizing around dead ideas, that's not a good thing. So how do you marry top-down, bottom-up, so that people are really moving in a productive direction?
Yeah, no, there's a very high risk that folks will launch projects that are meant to really preserve the dead ideas. We call that managed decline. or managed adaptive decline. It takes on some of the words and phrases of a different way of thinking about stuff, but it's just aimed at preserving a status quo. I mean, building a highway bridge across the Columbia River in a time that calls for investment in transit is a clear failure to understand the emerging conditions of oil scarcity, of global warming, of the potential of transit to make much bigger labor markets than could ever be made by auto. To me, Joe's right, and the folks pushing that bridge are wrong. And the difference is Joe really understands what the emerging conditions are, and the folks that are pushing the bridge do not. So the most critical thing in the conversation we're trying to do here is to focus on what are the emerging conditions, because if you get agreement about that, then the opportunities will follow pretty logically from that. But if you've skipped that process of saying what are the key emerging conditions, then you are more likely than not to get engaged in managed decline. And there's a lot more managed decline going on than there is reinvention.
Kip, what comes next after this first set of conversations? What do you imagine the process looking like?
Well, we're starting with very much of an overview as a first event, and then we're planning a total of 6 events. But the next 3 will be different than the first one in that we'll focus on a specific opportunity. We'll still be hashing through conditions around that opportunity, but it will be more focused. So we plan to have one looking at this emerging Northeast mega region. We plan to have one after that on how do you build an innovation workforce, and then a 3rd one after that on how do you make Stanford, particularly downtown Stanford, the kind of place that we talked about earlier that's greener, more interactive, more resilient, more connected, more transit-oriented. You kind of get the sense that when you theme the conversation in that way, it naturally increases the probability that specific action will come out of it. But it's also just another way of looking at the conditions. And if at the end of this 6-session conversation that's going to take place over the next 6 or 8 months, if we have 100 or so thought leaders in Stanford who have come to a shared understanding of the conditions, that would be a huge success in my eyes.
Kip, I wish you much good luck with the process. Your thinking in Stanford will influence us all. I thank you for being my guest on Smart City.
Glad to be here.
Kip Bergstrom is the director of the Stanford Urban Development Commission and the creator of the series Reinventing Stanford. He joined us from his office in downtown Stanford. And now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
They're so almost completely obsolete, it's kind of hard to even remember needing them. But pay telephones used to be as ubiquitous and essential in cities as stoplights and driveways. The rise of mobile communications brought on their gradual demise, but now one city is hoping to snip the last cord. Officials in Jacksonville, Florida are looking to permanently remove many payphones from parts of downtown. But it's not just futurism that's pushing for the removal. According to a recent article in the Florida Times Union, officials are targeting the crime and malfeasance that tends to gravitate towards payphone boxes. The legislation is going before the Jacksonville City Council for approval, where officials are calling it a, quote, crime reduction effort. Meanwhile, solar energy is on the rise in California. But it's not the stimulus package or even the pro-clean energy influence of President Barack Obama. The boom in California is being fueled largely by municipal financing. A recent article in the New York Times explores the huge growth in solar panels on California homes, which has been made possible by a minor change in state law that allows the large initial costs of installing solar panels to be financed the same way as gas or water lines. With more favorable loan terms and a wider group of eligible applicants, the once intimidating initial costs of installing solar panels are now just falling into the realm of reality for many homeowners, not just the wealthy. And in the 2 years since public financing has been available from a handful of California cities for solar power, half a dozen states have followed, with their own solar power financing bills either approved or on their way. And finally, here's a thought. Recycle the suburbs. Sounds good, doesn't it? With plummeting home values and skyrocketing foreclosures, America's suburbs aren't doing a whole lot of good these days. Turning them around may require drastic change. That's what Time magazine says anyway, in its recent list of 10 ideas that are changing the world right now. Though some suburbs are dying, we can't just throw them away, according to the article. Many of these areas can be preserved, but some will have to evolve. One major way this can happen is by reusing malls and shopping centers to create town centers where none existed before. Smart growth advocates argue that by recycling the assets these places already have, they can grow into better places that can remain viable, both for the economy and the environment. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor for Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll hear more about reinventing Stanford from the man who runs the city. Mayor Dan Malloy joins us to tell us about governing a city in the midst of this economic shift. I'm Carol Coletta. Hello to our podcast listeners. I'm Carol Coletta. On a show like Smart City, we tend to ask more questions than we could ever hope to answer in 1 hour a week. So we have a place online where we continue these conversations, a social networking site called My City. It's where we talk about the issues we bring up on the show, and also it's a great place to see what's going on in the world of urban planning and design, city government, and urban life. We'd love to have you join us. Email Scotty, our Smart City producer, at scotty@smartcityradio.com. He'll get you set up. We hope you'll join us online. We want to hear what's going on in your city. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Mayor Dan Malloy is the longest-serving mayor in the history of Stanford, and he's facing the same challenges many urban leaders do: how to weather the current recession. He's now taking a leading role with the next evolution of the city. Mayor, you are serving your fourth term in Stanford, and times have been very good during your time in office. Has the current state of our economy brought Stanford to some sort of turning point?
Well, you know, I've been mayor for 14 years, which is longer than anyone else has served as mayor. The longest prior mayor served for 8 years. So I've seen ups and downs. I've seen a recovery in the 90s and a downturn in the dot-com bust and the 9/11 bust, and then certainly more growth and now going through a bust. But you know, what's been consistent through that period of time is that Stanford laid out a vision for the future that we really worked towards: good times, bad times, hard budgets, easy budgets. We knew we needed to lower crime and make Stanford one of the safest cities in America. We knew we needed to begin the process of improving an urban educational system. We knew we needed to address transportation woes, and we certainly knew that we needed to add affordable housing to Stanford, which is something that we've done a lot of.
For our listeners who are not familiar with Stanford, describe the city.
Well, Stanford's a city of about 122,000 people. It's about 33 miles from Manhattan. We have about 45,000 people come to work from outside of Stanford, and we're now sending about 14,000 city residents to employment elsewhere. So it's not a bedroom community, as those terms might be applied to some very small suburban communities outside of New York. It really is an employment and business center, and it is an old city, 375 years old, one of the oldest cities in America. But it is a city that has constantly reinvented itself. And I think just in the last 14 years, we've seen a couple of different iterations of who we are and what we all are, but ultimately working towards a goal of sustainability, of high employment, and an improved city structure.
What do you think Stanford needs to do to position itself to come out of this recession stronger for the future?
I think we've done it, to tell you the truth. We have one of the best educated workforces in America. We have addressed affordable housing and will continue to address it with thousands of additional units of housing. We have great nameplate, great employers here. We're prepared to take advantage of the continuing trend of diversification of locations for financial services as they rebound out of New York. I think we'll see more strength and more growth in that area. So we're diversifying who we are and what we are. We're addressing quality of life issues so that people will choose to live in Stanford, and clearly some people will choose to live outside of Stanford and commute into town. I think some of our biggest challenges are we are a large educational system with 15,200 students. We are in the process of ever improving that system, but I need to continue to work with the superintendent, the Board of Education, and future mayors, quite frankly, are going to have to do that.
Education's always a tough one. There is a discussion kicking off March 24th in Stamford called Reinventing Stamford. And one of the issues that will be discussed at that kickoff event is this idea of the emerging mega region of the Northeast. You already think of yourself in relationship to New York. Let me ask you, as mayor, how do you govern as part of a region? Where do regional considerations fit in to the agenda of a locally elected mayor?
I was born in Stamford. I went to college and law school in Boston, and I was a prosecutor in New York. So I certainly get the idea and traveled to Washington a lot to try to pursue funding for various projects here. So, you know, I understand the mega region, and it is far reaching. I think the point of the mega region, as you've used that term, or even the New York metropolitan region, is it presents opportunity. The winners will be the people who seize the opportunity. The losers will be the people who fail or the towns that fail to seize that opportunity. And what do I mean by seizing it? I think quality of life, I think urban educational improvement, I think affordable housing, transportation structures working together, so whether it's bus lines or train lines or access to airports. And clearly the number one issue to take advantage of the mega region to be a winner in this is to have the best quality workforce. Those things, I think we've done a lot of work to address those in Stamford, and I think we are poised to be a long-term winner in that equation.
And as you think about, again, playing in the region, you sound as if your approach to this is, let me make Stamford the best it can possibly be, and then we will match up well within the mega region to our competitors. Does it create more of a situation where it's really a region of competitors or a region of collaborators?
It's both. Let's be honest. The really unusual things that Stamford has done that other communities haven't done, and the reason that I can predict with some certainty that we'll be a winner in this, is that we've added 7,500 units of housing. We require 10% of all multifamily housing to be set aside as affordable. We get the idea that being on the Metro North line is a major plus for us. That's why we've built lots of parking. That's why we're willing to build more parking for commutation from people who want to leave Stamford to go to work. But we're also working just as hard on making commutation into Stamford easier, to be able to deliver people to the various buildings or operations around the city in a more seamless fashion. Now, I suppose if all the other leaders of communities are listening to this, they're going to say, gee, you know, maybe we should do some of the things that Stamford is doing. The reality, however, is that many of those communities do come to Stamford, do study what we're doing. White Plains, a neighbor of ours, not very far away, a smaller community, has come to Stamford over the last 10 years, studied what we set about to do, and is actively pursuing that as we speak.
You said that Stamford has long been on a course of evolution in terms of improving transportation, urban education, affordable housing. So for you, this conversation about reinventing Stamford sounds like it's more evolution than revolution.
Well, I think it is. I should say that I think when I ran for mayor 14 years ago, I think Stamford was at a tipping point, and it could have gone the other way. One of the things that I ran on specifically was that we needed to lower crime, that the kiss of death for urban areas are poor educational systems, high taxes, and high crime. We've done a good job, I think, in addressing all of those. Now, my taxpayers will complain, just like anybody else's taxpayers will, about high taxes, but we've actually put a relatively good level of taxation in. Certainly, we are a much better tax location, for instance, than Westchester County is in the New York region, and certainly much lower taxation than some of the surrounding cities throughout the New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut area. We are improving urban education system, very proud of that, and we made Stamford the fourth safest city in America in 2007. So we're addressing those things, but if we hadn't done that, I'm quite frankly, you wouldn't be interviewing us right now. You'd be interviewing someone else. I think it is evolution now. I think it was a little revolution back in 1995 when we really grabbed hold of city government. We really shook it up. We changed it. We changed our form of government, making it a stronger mayor form of government than it had been, to bring about some of the changes that the community believed needed to be made. And we made those changes, including allowing larger and taller buildings being built, including allowing much more housing and affordable housing specifically, including moving the UConn satellite campus from North Stamford down into the downtown of Stamford. Lots of things have been done in that 14-year period of time that really positioned Stamford to take advantage of, what will be, when the smoke clears, a very different competitive, worldwide competitive environment than we had just 2 years ago.
What are you doing to keep taxes lower in Stamford than in nearby cities?
Well, listen, I'm in my 14th year as mayor, and city-side spending, as opposed to educational spending, has been less than the rate of inflation over that 14-year period of time. Or to put it another way, I inherited a government in 1995 for city-side services that had more employees serving a smaller population of about 10,000 people than I have today. So, I think fiscal conservatism with respect to city expenses has been our hallmark. Now, how did we do that? We gave people technology to do their jobs. We gave people training to do their jobs. And ultimately, what we really did was we let people do their jobs. And they created efficiencies that allowed us to make smaller the workforce of the city government.
Are there issues or things that you would like to get started? Let's say you were going to be in office another 14 years. What have you, obviously you've not made all the progress you want to make and the things that you've been working on for a long time, but are there new issues emerging that you see will need to be tackled over the next 14 years, 15 years, that you see both for yourself in getting those 15 years started and perhaps a successor?
We want to build a light rail system in Stamford. I think it is the way to go for the future. We have a study underway, feasibility study underway for a light rail system, which would connect with our rail station, which is on the Metro North line, 222 trains coming through Stamford every day, second busiest train station on the Metro North line after Grand Central Station. We want to connect that to a light rail system that would deliver people throughout our downtown and actually about halfway through the length of Stamford up to the what's called the Bull's Head area, but about a half distance in the total of Stamford. And then, quite frankly, that could then be expanded further. The interesting thing about Fairfield County is all of these communities down here once had light rail systems. And, of course, like many other places, they were torn up. I want to reintroduce that or see it reintroduced into downtown Stamford and beyond and make other connections between Stamford and places like Greenwich and Darien and Norwalk and Bridgeport and Rye and Portchester and on the Westchester side of it. We need to acknowledge that people need greater mobility. They need better delivery systems. They need to get away and out of cars. And there's another issue. I think we need to be more energy efficient. And the communities that create energy efficiency and then have that as a model, as well as combating global warming, are going to be winners. I think we need to further institutionalize in Stamford this kind of sense of who we are internationally. When I became mayor, 2% of our school system population was Asian. It's now pushing 8%. We are a much more diverse community than we've ever been, and we celebrate that. And again, I think communities that take advantage of that international flavor are going to be winners in the long run. You want to be a place where people of different religious backgrounds feel comfortable in coming, living, and raising their families, because, quite frankly, you need those top-rank employees to be available to your top-rank companies.
How do you balance, Mayor, the need and the desire of citizens to have influence, have input, if you will, into what you are doing and what your priorities should be versus getting things done?
When I first became mayor 14 years ago, we instituted something called Mayor's Night In, Mayor's Night Out. So once a month, either in my office or at a bakery or the Elks Club or someplace else, I'm sitting down with everyday citizens one-on-one and hearing what their concerns are, their questions, their requests for service, or whatever. We also did the Citizen Service Bureau. So we have one-stop shopping for services that people can request. I also decided 14 years ago to teach a course as an adjunct professor at a local local university so that I could stay in touch with how people think and what they're thinking about, and particularly how young people think. You know, I'm 53 years old. I'm a lot older than I was 14 years ago. And you can become stiltified in your approach. And I think teaching for me has been one of the things that's kept me current. Certainly staying active in national organizations is another way to hear other points of view, the U.S. Conference of Mayors being one of the organizations that I'm extremely active with. But I've also participated in a number of architectural programs around the country and internationally, so I understand how people are approaching building cities differently. So, and then, you know, the bottom line is I do the family shopping. So I go to the grocery store and people stop me and I hear what people are thinking and saying. Now, you're never going to have a, you know, complete uniformity. People think I spend too much money in building parks, or they think I spend too much money in pursuing a light rail system, or they don't like this, or they don't like that. But, you know, what we've really decided to do is to try to keep the city moving forward, have a consensus, which we certainly do, that Stanford needs to evolve to be successful and to guarantee growth and increased investment. And that's what we're working towards, and we give lots of opportunity for input.
Is there anything that you would like to get from this series of discussions on reinventing Stanford? Is there insight that you're looking for?
Stanford's going to have a new mayor come December 1st, and this is an attempt to set the table for whoever that is, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, whether they have a strong municipal background or not so strong a municipal background, that they understand that mayors play a role. They can help direct, they can set out a vision, but they also need to be supportive and play a more active role in saying, defining who we are and what we are and how we're going to adapt to change. I think the bottom line is that I want the city to understand and its new leadership to understand that adaptability, adapting to what the market will force, or what the world economy will force, what labor will force on us, being able to adapt to that, do it responsibly and rapidly, is really the key to success.
One more question. What are you looking for from the Obama administration to support your work in Stanford?
Well, I think the Obama administration, Democratic administrations in general, get cities better. I've served with Democrats and I've served with Republicans. The Bush administration, like every Republican administration, perhaps with the exception of the Nixon administration, favored governors and state government, and that's the partner that they wanted to work with. Democratic administrations sometimes start playing with governors and states, but soon recognize that if you want to accomplish a lot quickly, then you've got to push down to the local level, that you've got to get the cities of 500,000 involved, and then the cities of 100,000 involved, and then the cities of 50,000. And if you can push into there, if you can get them to be adaptive and innovative, and you push your ideas through cities, then they actually blossom much more rapidly. So I want the Obama administration to continue to push a local involvement, interaction with mayors and city managers and town planners and the like, to bring about this comprehensive change, which it has 7.5 years left to bring about.
Mayor, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you very much, and best of luck to you.
Mayor Dan Malloy is in his fourth term as mayor of Stanford, Connecticut. He joined us from his office in downtown Stanford. The evolution of a city doesn't just affect the city and its residents. Stamford, Connecticut is part of the New York metro region, and its future is tied into the decisions made by leaders in other cities as well. But while cities in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut work for their own well-being, the Regional Plan Association is working to improve the quality of life for the entire region. Robert Yarrow is the president of RPA, and he's turned the organization into a powerhouse. I ask him how cities that are not New York fit into the plan for the region.
We're a regional group, and so we focus on the whole tri-state metropolitan area around New York, which is a 31-county region that encompasses most of Connecticut, southern New York, and the northern half of New Jersey. So we do work in a number of cities all over the metropolitan area, as far as New Haven and Hartford and Trenton and Poughkeepsie and places like that, that are as much as 100 or more miles from New York City.
And what is the trick? What is the outlook that leaders need both to connect their city to the greater region, and at the same time compete with others in the region on their own strengths?
Well, a couple of thoughts here. One is that the New York region is the largest metropolitan economy in the Western Hemisphere, probably the second largest in the world after Tokyo. The region's got a $1 trillion economy. If we were an independent country, we'd be in the top 10 economies in the world. And so the challenge for most places is to find their niche in that economy and to connect with the regional economy. Some cities, some older cities, older industrial cities, have been left out of the region's economy, and they're kind of donut holes in this otherwise prosperous region. And so what we try to do is to help them find their niche and to strengthen their connections with the rest of the region's economy. And in some cases, that means strengthening transportation links. In others, it's making sure that their residents have the skills to gain access to growing sectors of the economy. Other cases, it's focusing on the things they need to do to improve their quality of life or their image and plugging their local housing market into the regional housing market. You know, so the strategy is a little different in each place, but every city's got a unique role and has a unique set of assets and skills that can help them succeed in this large metropolitan economy.
And how does a city like a Stamford assess its strengths in the region, its particular strengths when it thinks about itself as part of this greater region?
Well, Stamford's a really interesting case because it's managed to reinvent itself at least a couple of times in the last 30 or 40 years. And Stamford was an older industrial city that lost most of its industrial base in the 1960s and 70s. And we worked with Stamford and business leaders and government and civic leaders in Stamford back in the 1960s to reposition Stamford for a different kind of economy. And one of the things that we did was to work with them to strengthen their transportation ties to New York and to the rest of the region. At that point, there was a failing private commuter rail line, the New Haven Railroad, that was in bankruptcy. And we worked with the state of New York and the state of Connecticut to create the Metro-North Commuter Railroad, which is now the most successful commuter railroad in the country, second largest after the Long Island Railroad in terms of ridership. And that's been a key to Stamford's success. So it was really strengthening their ties to New York City. At the time, a number of corporate headquarters were relocating out of Manhattan, and we worked with Stamford to position downtown Stamford as a prime location for companies that were considering a move out of Manhattan. And since then, they've transformed themselves again as a financial services center, and they're in the process of doing this a third time and thinking about what's next and how to position themselves for the shifts that are underway in the New York regional economy and in the global economy.
How do you get two cities in a region to work together, as you say, when you say, well, we're positioning Stamford to be the home of those companies thinking of moving out of Manhattan? That can't be fun for the mayor of New York to hear. So how do you keep them cooperating?
Well, it's not so much keeping the cities cooperating. It's working with the individual companies. We're regionalists. You know, we're headquartered in Manhattan, but we work with communities across the metropolitan area. And you know, we're never advocates for businesses moving, you know, to any particular place. But when companies tell us that they, for their own selfish or unselfish reasons, just for their bottom line reasons, feel that they need a different location, we very often will work with them to make sure that they end up in a place that actually adds value for the whole region. I mean, the worst case for us is to have company leave altogether. That does happen from time to time. We'll usually work with companies to try to help them find a suitable location that meets their business needs and the needs of their workers. You know, best case is if a company relocates in the metropolitan area around transit in an urban center that's connected with the rest of the regional economy. And so we try to help companies find those locations and make those connections.
You've been one of the principal advancers, if you will, of this notion of a mega region. What propels a collection of cities in fairly close proximity to becoming a mega region, where everyone is really feeding off of everyone else, and it takes on the characteristics of something where 1 + 1 = 3?
Well, let's start with the notion of the mega region is that these are linked networks of metropolitan areas that have shared economies, shared infrastructure systems, shared natural resources systems, in many cases shared cultural traditions or histories. And in the Northeast, the way I like to describe it is that at the moment we've got all the disadvantages of being in the most expensive, congested place in the United States, and we're not getting a lot of the advantages. We're not getting the synergies out of the close juxtaposition of cities like New York and Philadelphia, for example. And it's pretty striking that New York and Philly are 90 miles apart. I take the train from Stanford to Philadelphia, where I teach at the University of Pennsylvania, you know, at least once a week. And, you know, I've clocked it averages about 58 miles per hour. And we've compared that with Osaka and Nagoya in Japan, which have the Shinkansen high-speed rail link. And there, of course, the trains do 150 miles per hour. And if we had a 150-mile-per-hour train connecting New York and Philly, of course, it would cut travel time to under half an hour, which is what it probably should be ultimately. So the potential is there to create economic advantages for residents and businesses in both New York and Philly in terms of new business locations, new opportunities for workers in both cities to have access to employment in both cities, for industries to be able to draw on skilled workers from both cities and so forth. And, you know, I don't think that anyone contemplates that people are going to be commuting from Boston to Washington if we had a decent high-speed rail link, but they certainly could be moving more frequently between the closer-in pairs. And the opportunities, we've seen this in Europe and in Asia, that when these mega-region strategies are implemented, usually through high-speed rail and other related strategies, that in fact there are new business linkages that are created, that there are new, the economists call it agglomerations of activities, industries, and so forth that are created. And that's how you get from 1 and 1 equals 1.1 to 1 and 1 equals, well, you said 3, I'll say 11, because that's when you get real synergies going between places. That's what we're looking for.
And so how does Stanford think of its role in the Northeast Corridor mega region?
Well, I think Stanford understands and has built upon its rail links to New York. What we're looking at is the potential for Stanford to, in the short term, with improved commuter rail links in the Northeast, in Connecticut, and linking Stanford with New Jersey, for example. And the Metro-North and Metropolitan Transportation Authority here in New York and New Jersey Transit are working on a proposed network of through services that would allow people to get from Stanford, for example, to Newark or the Princeton corridor. And so some of these improvements are underway now. We've got a set of rail improvements here in the core of the region, the East Side Access Project that brings Long Island Railroad into Grand Central Terminal, and then the access to the region's core rail project that is a new rail tunnel from New Jersey into Manhattan. And both of these free up capacity at Penn Station, which is the choke point in the Northeast Corridor right now. These projects are underway now. The East Side Access is mostly constructed. ARC is mostly funded. We'll have a construction start later this year with some of the federal stimulus money, getting it over the top. And so we're now planning on ways that these through services could benefit cities like Stanford and Newark and New Brunswick and Bridgeport and others that are on the Northeast Corridor. And then in the longer run, I think we're looking at how higher speed rail, you know, what we've called an Acela that works, just getting it up to from 58 or 68 miles per hour to 100 or 110 or 120 means that Stanford can build new relationships with places like Hartford and Springfield and Providence and Boston. You know, and it puts Connecticut kind of squarely in between New York and Boston, and creating synergies with both of these big metros. And these are both enormous regional economies, enormous centers of innovation and business and so forth.
There is an interesting discussion planned for Stanford that proposes attacking the recession with community-driven innovation. In your mind, what does that look like? What could that look like?
My throwaway line is that every city and every region has to reinvent itself from time to time, and Stanford has done this twice now in the last say 40 years, and the business leadership and the civic and government leadership in Stanford know that it's probably time for them to do it again. Stanford is one of the top three or four financial services hubs in the country, but a number of the big employers in downtown Stanford, UBS and RBS and others, are clearly going through a transition, aren't going to be driving employment growth perhaps the way they might have. So Stanford is taking a very proactive look at what it needs to do to reposition itself in national and global markets. And this is exactly the kind of process you want to see, bottom-up process of local business, civic government leaders thinking through what the next transformation has to be. And my understanding is that they're beginning with a look at things like how to reposition Stanford because of its location in the mega region. So this will be one of the first cities to take advantage of this this concept and take advantage of the improved transportation links that are being built now, and also anticipating what the next generation of improvements in higher speed and high speed rail services could provide. They're also looking at how to reposition Stanford's workforce to give them the skills that they'll need to succeed in the next economy. And then finally, they're looking at how the physical fabric of Stanford and its downtown and the nearby residential neighborhoods can be transformed to make it an even more attractive place for people to live and work. And again, a lot of this is all about attracting talented, creative people. And we know that those people go to where the quality of life is best and where the opportunities, the economic opportunities, are greatest. So quality of life is really important. The physical appearance and the way and the functionality of a urban center is really important. Not a frill, it's just fundamental to the success of the place. And so Stanford's looking at that as well, and how they can, and they've done a lot already, but how they can engineer the next generation of civic improvements and public spaces and quality urban placemaking.
Is there anything you think they've left off the agenda that should be there?
That's a great place to begin, I think, with the framework that the city and its business leaders have created. I suspect that in this process, we're going to find that other things are going to emerge. There may be specialized kinds of infrastructure that are going to be needed. There may be other governance, you know, issues that come up, or regulatory issues that come up. But I think it's a really good start. And again, this is a creative process. There are going to be dozens of people. By the time we're done, hundreds of business, civic leaders, concerned citizens involved in this dialogue. And it's a creative process, so you can be sure that there will be new ideas emerging.
One more question. Is it your sense, Bob, that it's smart for cities to put a stake in the ground around the kind of economy they want and then try to attract companies and entrepreneurs there? Or do you think it makes a lot more sense instead to sort of build the fundamentals, the things that we know we'll need, like talent, like attractive places that attract talent, like good school systems that develop talent, that can then power any industry as those industries emerge? Which side of that do you fall on?
I definitely fall on the side of focusing on the fundamentals. You know, get the quality of life locked down, make sure your citizens have the skills, make sure that the infrastructure works, that you're connected with the nearest metropolitan area, or, you know, that you're plugged into the mega region. And I think if you get those things right, then the talented people and the industries will follow. I guess the last piece I would, you know, say, and the last ingredient, of course, is the leadership has to be there, that in fact you've got to have, and it's business, civic, and government leadership, not just from government. The cities that have the leadership, that once you've identified the investments that need to be made, identify the policies that need to be put in place and so forth, you've got to have the leadership there to follow through. And I also like to say that things take time. This is not something that happens in an afternoon or a weekend or a month or two. That in fact, the kinds of transformation that we're talking about can take a decade or longer to put in place. But getting these investments in place, getting the policies right, making a place attractive and functional is the key. And then I think do those things, and the talented people and the new businesses will follow.
Bob, thanks for talking with us today.
Sure. Thanks very much. Enjoyed it.
Robert Yarrow is the president of the Regional Plan Association. His interview was engineered by Jennifer Ball. Want to know more about Stamford, Connecticut and the series that will plan its future? We have links to more information on our website, smartcityradio.com. While you're there, you can get in touch and let us know how we're doing. Just click the contact button or send us an email at questions@smartcityradio.com. You can also subscribe to our podcast, which this week includes extended interviews with all of our guests. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. We had engineering help from Joe Burst. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.